As you've heard, my name's Anthony Specker. I come to you from Iqaluit, Nunavut, which is the capital of Nunavut on Baffin Island. It was a long way to get here, and it cost a lot of money. And that will become important in what we talk about, over the next hour or so, about the human security and economic and human development of the Arctic. I'm extremely glad to be here, especially because of the topic that we're discussing today, human security and development in the Arctic. This is a pressing subject. For me, this is the pressing subject, but it's at least as much, in my opinion, if not more important than breathless news coverage of who owns the North Pole, will there be conflict with Russia in the Arctic, and that perennial chestnut, where did that other ship of the Franklin expedition actually get to? So it is important to say up front, and Mary has said it, that the Arctic is a huge region with a huge region of the world with enormous regional variation within it. There are many different Arctics, as we've just heard, and there are going to be many different perspectives on human security and development. So I will be focusing here on the Arctic that I know best, or the part of the Arctic that I know best. That's the Eastern Canadian Arctic, specifically the territory of Nunavut in Canada. And just to give you some perspective, it's a young territory. It was created in 1999, so it's only 16 years old as a government. Previously, it was part of the Northwest Territories. It's about 20% of the land mass of Canada, Canada being the second largest country in the world. So we're talking about 2 million square kilometers, approximately. That's about 25% bigger than Alaska. You could fit 3 Texases, 3 states of Texas in Nunavut. It's virtually all above the tree line, so in the Arctic by anyone's definition, whether climatic or political. But it only has about 35,000 people in it, not enough to fill a sports stadium, spread out between 25 fly-in communities, none of which, that what I mean, is accessible by road. You either have to fly there or take a boat there when the sea is not frozen, which is less often than it is in the year. 85% of the people of Nunavut are Inuit. So Inuit and Aboriginal people, the Inuit, make up the vast majority of Nunavut's population. But politically, what you need to know about Nunavut is that the Nunavut government is not an Inuit government. The territory of Nunavut was created out of a land claims agreement with the Inuit, but the government is a public government. Constitutionally, Nunavut is the same as the Northwest Territories or Yukon. It was created by an act of parliament, and the government represents, though the government, for example, the politicians are, many of them are Inuit, and their constituencies are 85 or whatever percent Inuit. The government of Nunavut represents all Nunavumiut, whether Inuit or not, living within the territory. The other thing that you need to know, that besides that it's not an Inuit government, rather a public government, is that it is a creature of the Canadian Parliament. It is a territory and not a province, which means it has no inherent sovereignty. It has no part of the Canadian Crown. It exists, as I said, through an act of parliament and has all and only those powers which the Canadian government is willing to grant it. Okay. That's going to become important later on as well. Now, I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, a magic lantern show for you. I'd rather tell you some stories. That's how I'd like to approach the question of human development, through a series of sort of stories or examples, not of individual people, rather, but about stories about Nunavut and what Nunavut is like and how it got to the way it is. So my ultimate focus here is not going to be on practical policy prescriptions. I've written about practical policy prescriptions, and I'm happy to discuss them in discussion or give you a link to the articles where I've made policy prescriptions, all of them ignored, I just don't know why, by the federal government. But as I said, we can talk about that. But rather, what I would like to do, instead of talking about practical policy prescriptions, is make a plea for a change of mindset about the North, and about Nunavut specifically, and perhaps by extension to places like Alaska or other places in the Arctic, but a change of mindset that I think is fundamentally necessary to remove obstacles to human development and human security in the Arctic and to make any further progress on human security and development in the Arctic. And why do I want to take this approach about a change of mindset rather than practical policy prescriptions? It's because I think there is a moral dimension to this question, a moral dimension to the question of human security and development of the Arctic that cannot be addressed simply with an economist's sort of technical solution. And so I want to sort of pull on your moral sense here a little bit with my stories and challenge you to change perhaps the way you look at the Arctic, or maybe you're already there with me and I'm preaching to the converted, which would be great, but to get you to see the sort of the moral dimension of the question that we're talking about. Okay? So to set the stage, let's talk about underdevelopment for a minute. Underdevelopment in the sense of resources not being used to their full socioeconomic potential. Let's call that underdevelopment for a minute. That is chronic in Nunavut. This is true of much natural capital in Nunavut, which is stranded because Nunavut is difficult of access. I mean, Nunavut is basically blessed with virtually everything that you could think of to dig out of the ground. Iron, zinc, copper, silver, gold, diamonds, oil, gas, uranium, sapphires, you name it, you probably can find it in Nunavut. Platinum, cobalt, nickel. But all of this natural capital is stranded because there is no infrastructure. There exists no infrastructure, very little infrastructure to get at it. What I'm really more focused on, apart from that being underdeveloped, it's underdeveloped because these resources are not being extracted, is it's also true of human capital in the Arctic, that human capital is underdeveloped. Now, you're probably all familiar with the Human Development Index, right, the UN's HDI. That's not quite a measure of human security as it is of human development, I guess, but let's go with that for a minute. You're probably also aware that on this measure of human development, Canada comes out in the top 10 countries in the world alongside, you know, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, those sorts of countries, more often than it doesn't. So Canada is considered a leader, a world leader in human development. When I would sit around sometimes with my colleagues at the government of Nunavut, we would ask ourselves, I wonder what the HDI for Nunavut would be. Not Canada, but Nunavut. And finally, a think tank in Ottawa decided to do this exercise for every province and territory in Canada. So we got an HDI for Ontario, an HDI for Quebec, an HDI for Nunavut. And the HDI for Nunavut was really telling. As you know, there are three components to the HDI. There's a measure of wealth in terms of GDP per capita. There's a measure of educational attainment and a measure of life expectancy, which is a proxy for health. And it's the last two that I'm worried about here. On measures of life expectancy and educational attainment, Nunavut was on par with the occupied Palestine and Paraguay. Not Canada, not Finland, not Iceland. So Canada's HDI is masking a huge human development issue in Nunavut. So bear that in mind, and I want to tell you a story, my first story, about that helps explain how Nunavut got to this point. And so I'm going to take you back to the eastern Canadian Arctic of the 1970s. This is not Nunavut now. Nunavut didn't exist. It's part of the Northwest Territories. In the 1970s, the last Inuit were moving off the land and into villages, the communities that now exist in Nunavut. These villages were created mostly for the convenience of the federal government to provide, quote unquote, public services to the Inuit, not for the convenience of Inuit, who were, many of them at that time, still living a subsistence life. It was also convenient for the federal government to have a place where they could access Inuit for residential schooling and that sort of thing, for which the government is still, I don't think, made complete amends. But leaving that aside, let's just think about what moving into communities might mean for a traditional culture that depends on a seasonal round on the land. You're now further away from the animals that you depend on. So in order to continue a traditional lifestyle, or at least a partial traditional lifestyle, you have to become a more efficient hunter. So the Inuit didn't give up their hunting life. They became more efficient hunters. How do you become a more efficient hunter? Well, you adopt more efficient technology. That more efficient technology was snowmobiles, motorboats, rifles. Those things allowed Inuit to go out and continue to access animals on the land. But those things required money. So now your hunting kit requires money. So you live in a mixed economy, right, where you need money in order to keep up a traditional culture. Now, fortunately for the Inuit at that time, that money was readily obtainable by selling onto the global market excess pelts of seal. So the seal, especially for the Baffin Inuit, was a large part of the diet. You were taking more seal than you needed the fur from, so there was excess fur to be sold in the market. At that time, one day's hunting could be paid for by a single seal skin. Then, as we all know, countries around the world started banning the importation of seal. Not the seal that the Inuit were hunting, mind you, but the cuddly white pups of the harp seal, which were being hunted in Newfoundland. There was a large campaign, Greenpeace, for example, and other organizations were spearheading that campaign. We all know about the visits of Brigitte Bardot and others onto the ice, hugging seals, or spray painting them so that their pelts would become valueless. First, the United States responded. That was 1972 with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which banned the importation of marine mammal parts into the UK, not just seal, but all kinds. This was bound up with whaling and polar bears and all the rest. But that was not so important because the US was never a huge market for seal pelts. It was when Europe followed suit by banning the importation of seal skins in 1983 that things began to go sour. Because you see, despite the fact that the ban included an exemption for Inuit for their subsistence lifestyle, and despite the fact that the ban focused on the pelts of pup, harp seals, and hooded seals, the campaign against sealing completely tainted the whole idea of wearing seal. So even ring seal pelts, adult ring seal pelts, from a subsistence harvest, became valueless. So whereas, as I said before, a single seal pelt could pay for a day's worth of hunting before 1983, after the ban in 1983, a single seal pelt wouldn't even buy a box of bullets. The government of the Northwest Territories, which was in charge of the Eastern Canadian Arctic at the time, estimated that about 60% of the income of Inuit communities was overnight wiped out, vanished. These communities were instantaneously impoverished. And that ban still exists, by the way. It has recently been extended. The European Union in 2009 banned seal pelts entirely, not just from the pups of harps and hooded seals, but just seal pelts generally, still with an Inuit exemption. And again, the market, which had recovered slightly, once again crashed. And I tell this story because not only does it tell you a little bit about why Nunavut's HDI indicators might be so low, but also because it tells you something about the obstacles that we put, maybe as a matter of collateral damage, but the obstacles that we put in the way of human development of the Arctic by pursuing our southern interests, whatever they happen to be, without regard or without enough regard for the kind of damage that can do to northern communities. Now think, this is not just an abstract exercise, you know, about talking about the past. Think about now. What campaign, what bans are being proposed on Arctic activity? I can think of one prominent campaign right now, Save the Arctic, Greenpeace's Save the Arctic campaign, which would see a ban on oil and gas drilling entirely in the Arctic. To Inuit, the people of the North, this looks like the same mistake again. So if oil and gas, for example, in Greenland, is the path to a self-reliant economy, as many Greenlanders see it to be, if countries applied a ban on drilling oil and gas in the Arctic, we will have, again, put another obstacle in the way of economic development in the Arctic. Not to say that people in the Arctic want to see a forest of oil derricks off their shores. People in the Arctic are conflicted about the benefits of oil and gas development, and they're fully aware of the possible consequences. It's just that they want to be the ones to decide how to balance that question, not have it decided by southern interests again in a way that treats their communities as collateral damage in a greater fight for something else. So these are sort of the kinds of things that we should avoid if we want to promote human security and development in the Arctic. We have to listen to the people in the Arctic about how they want that development to happen. We have to stop putting obstacles in their way. So that's one story. That sort of explains partly explains how Nunavut got to the point where it is now. Now I want to tell you another story, that something that is helping keep Nunavut the way it is, with educational and life expectancy indicators on the order of, you know, sort of on par with occupied Palestine and Paraguay. And not to mince words, I don't know if anyone from the Canadian Embassy is in the audience. The Canadian federal government is not fulfilling its responsibility to the territory of Nunavut. And I'll explain what I mean by telling you a story about how it is that the federal government actually funds public services in the north. The government of Nunavut depends on a block grant from the federal government for approximately 90% of its budgetary spending. As I said, the government of Nunavut is a public government. It is not an Inuit government. The Inuit themselves do not provide public services. It is the government of Nunavut that provides public services on the behalf of all Nunavumiut, 85% of whom are Inuit. So this is the Nunavut budget I'm talking about. That's schools, that's health care and medical travel to the south when needed. That's policing and justice and housing and economic development and our airports, transportation of all sorts, license plates and driver's licenses, that sort of thing. The government of Nunavut provides all of these services, and they rely on the federal government for 90% of the budget to provide those services. Now, how does the federal government decide how much money to give to Nunavut every year to provide these services? Well, there's a formula called Territorial Formula Financing, TFF, and it's essentially a gap-filling formula. It makes very good sense. You calculate what is the expenditure need in a given year to provide public services? You calculate what is the revenue generating capacity of the government of Nunavut itself, and then you subtract one from the other. And that gap, you just fill up with the grant. Right? So here's the expenditure need, subtract off revenue generating capacity of Nunavut, and fill up the rest with the grant from the federal government. And like I say, that grant accounts for 90% of the spending. So what we're generating is about 10%, our revenue generating capacity. So if you think about how that formula works, the most important part of it is figuring out what the expenditure need is going to be. Now you'd think perhaps the expenditure need was calculated on the basis of some kind of systematic or scientific kind of enumeration of the things that a prudent government would have to pay for to give comparable public services to its citizens that citizens in southern Canada have, but you'd be wrong. In the 1980s, the early 1980s, when the federal government decided to institute this gap-filling formula, it used to be that the commissioner for the territories, would get a set of spending priorities from the territorial legislature, which at that time had only existed for about 7 years. This is the territorial legislature of the Northwest Territories, and would go line by line and approve or deny each of those spending items. Then what was needed was added up, and that was the grant. Ottawa decided that as part of the political development of the territories, that they should be responsible for spending their own money however they wanted to spend it. So the territorial legislature would just be given a block grant, and then they could allocate it to their priorities as they wanted, without a commissioner going through and saying yes or no line by line. So how do you figure out what the block grant is? They said, well, what are we spending now? X number of dollars? Well, that's it. That's the grant. That's the need. It wasn't, okay, are we actually spending enough to deliver comparable public services in Nunavut? What do the people in Nunavut, or sorry, this is the Northwest Territories, the Northwest Territories need in order to attain human security and to develop economically? And it was simply a question of what was the federal government spending up to that point. And now that number has escalated by population growth and other factors. It has been arbitrarily cut and also boosted. But overall, the core of the block grant is about what the federal government is willing to spend and not what the territory's citizens actually need. So I wouldn't even call it expenditure need. I would just call it what the federal government is willing to see go out the door. If Nunavut's HDI is, as I told you, on par with the occupied Palestine and Paraguay in terms of educational attainment and life expectancy, it should be clear to anyone that what the government is willing to spend is simply insufficient to provide comparable public services that other Canadians enjoy. And if you need further data on that, pick any social indicator that you can think of, crime, health, overcrowding, tuberculosis rates, graduation rates. All of these are much, much, much worse than they are in southern Canada. Suicide rates are 10 times the national average. One-third of the population is food insecure. 50% of the territory relies on social assistance. 50% of the households in the territory rely on social assistance in one form or another. 50% are in social housing. In some communities, it goes up to as high as 80%. There are no roads. All the airports, except for one or two, have dirt runways and they are visual landing only. All the power plants are 30 or 40 years old and burn diesel. Power cuts are common in some places. Iglulik has just gone off a boil water advisory because there were harmful bacteria in the water system. These sorts of things, these sorts of social outcomes would not be tolerated in southern Canada, but they seem to have to be tolerated in the north because the federal government doesn't seem willing to fulfill its financial responsibility to the territory to provide comparable public services. So, why do I mention this in particular? I mention this because if Nunavut is ever going to achieve the levels of human security and human development that the people who live in Nunavut deserve, it's going to have to start first with government. And this is important because we often tend to talk about the private sector when we talk about economic development. But the private sector depends on the government having already provided a certain base of infrastructure, of a labor force, an educated labor force, a healthy labor force, and all the rest. And the government is simply not doing that in Nunavut. So you're not going to get human development in Nunavut simply by relying on market forces. All that is doomed to fail, really. I mean, I believe in the public sector as much as anyone else, and Nunavut has made incredible strides since the 1917, since the times that I took you back to. They have a land claim with the Inuit of Nunavut have a land claim with the federal government. They are owners of about 20% of the territory, including mineral rights. The territorial government is now separate, can make its own decisions on many issues, is negotiating the devolution of resources, lands and resources as well, has tax-raising powers. All of these things are amazing achievements. Inuit are pilots and doctors and lawyers and teachers. None of that is going to change. None of that can be taken away. But there's still a very, very long way to go. And we're not going to get there unless, I think, the government stops thinking of the North as a national space where it has local agents, namely the territorial government, to deliver public services as cheaply as possible, and rather thinks of it as an integral part of Canada, where citizens deserve comparable services at comparable levels of taxation. Interestingly, of course, that's how the government talks about the North, but the proof is in the pudding. You can talk your vision all you want, but unless you're willing to put your hand in your pocket to make that vision happen, it's just so many words on paper, really. So now you might say, well, wait a minute here, Anthony. Is it really like that? Is it really just the federal government's fault? Is there not a local mindset change needed here? I'm asking for a mindset change. Is there not a local mindset change needed? Now, full disclosure, I used to work for the government of Nunavut, so perhaps I'm biased. But all the same, I do know that the government of Nunavut, like any government, can be wasteful with its money and inefficient with its money. There have been overruns on major projects. These things are nothing new to any government, but of course they're all the more problematic in a place like Nunavut, where the money is perhaps not enough to provide the right kind of infrastructure. But I wonder if the government of Nunavut would not be more efficient if it were actually properly funded. I had a staff of 11 in the fiscal and economic policy shop. That staff was never even at half capacity. If I had wanted it to be at full capacity, we couldn't have afforded it, really. We couldn't have afforded it, because the money that we were saving on staff was being used for other things. So I think, really, there is such a huge gap between what Nunavut needs and what it is provided, that the mindset change first has to come from the South, from the federal government, to lay the foundations for true human security and economic development. Now, you also might say, Anthony, why this emphasis on government here? I know you say that that's the basis for things, but doesn't the private sector have a role to play? Yes, the private sector has a role to play. I agree. Nunavut's private sector is led by construction, because there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built, by mining. There are two active mines in Nunavut. Fishing is a future industry that's developing, although Nunavut interests only have two-thirds of the quota, fishing quota, available in their adjacent waters, whereas interests in southern provinces, it's always in the high 90s%. There's another obstacle that's being put in the way of Nunavut's development. So that's really where the economy is focused right now. Jobs are certainly needed. One-third of the population is under 15. There's a high birth rate, over three births per woman. As I mentioned, the social assistance and social housing rates, so jobs are definitely needed. But here's the rub. Nunavut is an extremely high-cost location in which to do business. I talked about my airplane ticket getting down here. Anybody want to take a guess? A guess? How much does it cost to fly from Iqaluit, Nunavut, to Washington, D.C.? Well, gosh, I must have I've convinced a lot of people in this room already. 5,000 is a bit high. Yeah, it is lower than that. It was 2,500 approximately, 2,560. You can fly around the world and probably stay at a nice hotel somewhere for the amount of money that it took just to get me down here. Nunavut is a high-cost location because the transport is so costly, because the infrastructure isn't there when you get there. If you're a mining company, you have to build everything for your mine, everything, more or less. If you want to do business in Nunavut, you're faced with incredibly high broadband costs and terrible speeds. Commercial leasing rates are extremely high because there are not enough buildings, that sort of thing. And the Nunavut economy itself is very dependent on imports. So I told you that the federal government provides 90% of our budget. That's about $1.4 billion Canadian dollars a year. But Nunavut's import bill is a billion plus every year. So there's a tide of money that goes into Nunavut and comes back out in terms of buying things, food, fuel, construction materials, all of that sort of stuff has to be brought up. So if you want to do business in Nunavut, let alone live there, you're going to have to be importing probably all of the materials that are going to go into the goods that you're making, or the construction that you're doing, or whatever. You often have to import labor, because graduation rates are at 30%. There are only 35,000 people in the territory, so even if they were quite high, you might still need to import southern labor. So we're talking about an enormously, enormously high-cost jurisdiction. So again, in my mind, it comes back to government making, setting up the base would make it less expensive for the private sector to operate in the territory. So yes, the private sector has a role to play, but I always fall back on the government needs to put the platform in place in order for that momentum to take off. Now, what could be done? I mean, what could the government do to help businesses? Well, I've talked about the lack of infrastructure and all that sort of stuff. I mean, should we become like Argentina was in the 1970s and be in, you know, promote import substituting industrialization in the north? Well, that's not going to work because we could never grow our own food. You're not going to be a manufacturing destination, that sort of thing. Should it be an export-led growth on the model of South Korea or Japan? Well, maybe there's room for building northern champions, but think of what the north has to export. It's very low down the value chain. Fish, minerals, oil and gas. Nobody's going to build an enormous smelter in Nunavut because it's so expensive to do that work there. You're going to mine your stuff and get it out and take it somewhere where it's cheaper to refine. Right? You're going to get your fish out of the water. And it turns out that it's, right now, there are no fish plants, or there's just one for a small inshore fishery in Nunavut, but there are plenty across the way in Greenland or down in Newfoundland, so you take your fish out. So these are, this lack of infrastructure, these are obstacles that we need to remove. So again, I come back to government. Who's going to be able to do that? Who's going to be able to build small craft harbors, fish plants, that sort of thing, processing plants? It's going to take government help. So, time for a reality check. It's going to take government help. There's a lot that needs to be done. The gaps are huge. The challenge is great. But let's be clear. The Arctic is never going to be the economic center of Canada. The Arctic is always going to be on the periphery. In many ways, this is a good thing. Being on the periphery has helped preserve a unique culture and a unique environment so far. This is not something that we want to throw away lightly, even as we pursue all guns blazing human security and human development in the Arctic. But what this does mean, the Arctic is never going to be, the Nunavut is never going to be the economic center of Canada, is that Nunavut, even the ideal Nunavut, where the government has put that infrastructural base in place, that educational base in place, that health base in place, Nunavut is still always, I think, going to depend on federal assistance to offer public services at acceptable levels. For me, the HDI figures that I told you about, that's all you need to know. The moral case is paramount. But if you need a sort of a cost-benefit analysis, if the federal government of Canada needs a cost-benefit analysis, it should think of what it's paying for, slightly paying for, maybe less than it's actually giving in money, but still getting a return on. The example here I want to leave you with is the Canadian Rangers. They are a militia force in the north. They provide military services essentially on the cheap. They provide their own vehicles. They provide their own skills on the land. They're issued with a little bit of equipment, and they do sovereignty patrols. They assist in search and rescue, and they help the regular forces when they're on exercise or doing anything up in the Arctic. The government is getting this, I think, slightly too cheaply, but there is a model for services that the North can provide. And the major service that the North provides, that the people of the North provide to the federal government, is you might want to think of as a sovereignty service. Canada's claim to the Arctic depends on effective occupation under international law. That effective occupation has always been provided by the people who live in the Arctic. That sovereignty would be strengthened. The healthier those communities are, the better off those people are, the more they are integrated into Canada. And that's worth paying for. And what I've tried to argue for you, to you, is that the government isn't fully paying for it because of the lack of human security, the lack of human development there. And I think perhaps if the government would think of what it's getting in return, it might be more willing to step up to the plate. The government could also think of the cultural benefits, the diversity that Canada gets for having vibrant Aboriginal communities. I think that's worth paying for. But again, I come back to the moral case. These people are citizens of Canada. Nunavummiut are citizens of Canada. The Inuit are citizens of Canada. They deserve public services, comparable public services to any other citizens of Canada. They should not be shortchanged, which is, I'm afraid, what's happening now. So let me leave you with a couple of quotes. A former Deputy Minister of the Arctic was always fond of telling a story about a debate in the Canadian Parliament about paying for a large piece of infrastructure, a large piece of sort of national infrastructure. And there's a quote in Hansard, an MP during the debate stands up and he says, "Why should we be bankrupting Confederation to provide this infrastructure and these services to these people who live so far away?" And then he asks people, what far away people do you think they were talking about? Is it the people of Nunavut or the people of the Northwest Territories? No, this was the late 19th century, and it was the people of British Columbia that these MPs didn't want to spend any money on. And they were talking about spending money for the Transcontinental Railroad, the railroad that joined East and West and integrated British Columbia into the Canadian Confederation. And now nobody would think that that was a bad investment. Not in the slightest would anybody think it was a bad investment. Not in the slightest would anybody think the people in BC live just oh so far away and Confederation shouldn't concern themselves with them. But people still do think this way about Nunavut in the Arctic. So maybe there's that change of mindset that I was talking about. The other quote I want to leave you with is from Mary Simon, who is an Inuk leader from Northern Quebec, one of the great Inuit leaders of Northern Canada. She said, in response to the Harper, the current Prime Minister's Northern initiatives, the Use It or Lose It initiatives, after Russia planted the flag at the North Pole, well, we better use our North or we're going to lose it. She said, look, and I'm quoting here now, "For generations, Canadians have professed to be a people of the North. The reality, however, is that the Arctic has been on the margins of Canadian consciousness. Luckily for Canada, the Inuit are always here. Without the Inuit, could we really claim to be masters of the Arctic house? Probably not." So my call is for a shift in consciousness that Mary Simon was talking about, in that moral sense, towards the people of the North, the ones who really live there. Thanks very much.